So how do we properly site the next generation of Australian kids in this region that people like Warwick Smith are so enthusiastic about? After all, we know they're certainly not learning its languages, but more than that, are they even properly introduced to it broadly in their schooling? Well, my next guest has drawn the reluctant conclusion that both in the past and he regrets in the immediate future, Asia will remain peripheral unless some things change. He believes that unless the Australian story, as he puts it, is expanded to include its Asian context, we won't have a hope of becoming the most Asia-literate society in the world, Kevin Rudd's dream. Even more, having this larger educational aim could, he believes, be educationally clever too by expanding the students' learnings. An Asian history professor from the ANU, Tony Milner, wants this new Australia-Asia story incorporated into the new national history curriculum under hot debate, we understand, behind closed doors virtually as we speak. And he laid out his case in an eloquent keynote address recently to a big group of school principals at the leading 21st Century Schools Forum, which I attended. But I'm delighted now to welcome him to Saturday Extra. Good morning.
Okay, good morning.
Tony Milner, we're all aware about this aspiration of the Prime Minister that we become the most Asia-literate country in the collective West. You don't believe, though, that our history curriculum, and as we're rewriting it, necessarily supports this vision?
Well, look, I think it's great that history's got the centrality that it seems to be being given now to in our national curriculum. That makes good sense, and I think that history really does matter, as they're arguing, in terms of creating common values and attitudes in our society. And there are also impressive people, dedicated people working on this curriculum. But we really need to turn things around. And this great sort of educational ships have built up a considerable momentum over the last almost, you know, couple of hundred years. And we really need a curriculum for now, for the first decades of the 21st century. And I suspect that the Prime Minister's absolutely right in saying that we need to be an Asia-literate country. And I think people on the other side of the world expect that of us.
It's so hard to understand, I think, why Asia might be peripheral, to use your phrase, when we're devising a curriculum for the next generation, given what's happening with China, Japan, and other parts of Asia.
But I think it has been generally pretty peripheral. I mean, not because it's deliberately being pushed aside, I think, but because we've been preoccupied with a great nation-building process.
Of our own.
Of our own. And, of course, in that process, European values, specifically, you know, British, Scottish values have been terribly important in this. So we've been focused on that nation-building. And in regional terms, that's a very important thing to have done. But and, of course, to do that, we have to know something of the European background. And so we look at European history as well as Australian history. Now, this is what our teachers, more or less, seem to me to be trained to do, and now we're asking something different of them, to prepare Australians for what I think we're in a new phase. That's the point in this region. I think although we've been, of course, in the Asian region for a long time, we first of all had European empires around us until the Second World War, and then we had the Cold War, and then we had this dream of globalisation. But I would have thought in the last decade or so, we're really addressing the Asian dynamics around us. And Australians, ordinary Australians, have to have that education.
So the weighting between, I think, the curriculum framing paper, as you describe it in your speech, calls for special attention to Europe, and yet a deeper knowledge of the Asia-Pacific is also described as a national priority. That very much came out of the 2020 summit. So you're saying the balance isn't quite right?
Yeah, I mean, these things are invoked. I mean, a knowledge of essays of the Asian regions invoked there, and that's good. But when you actually come down to look at the sort of curriculum that's being developed, it seems to me it's got a long way to go. And as I say, for very good reasons, the people writing it will have very little Asian knowledge to help them. I think that school teachers around the country have been involved in other sorts of projects, and now we're asking them to prepare Australians for something different. I'm now asking the question, do we need more slabs of Asia, Asian knowledge in a history curriculum? And that's one answer. But I think that'll be very hard to digest. But I've been focusing in my mind a bit on the whole question of the Australia story. It's how you tell the Australia story that might become quite important in preparing Australians to actually want that Asia literacy that the Prime Minister and many others have been talking about.
Yes. Well, indeed, how do you suggest that we might include Asia usefully and attractively in the curriculum?
Well, I think this is really important. I mean, we know at the moment, for instance, that in a survey done this year, that students, when they can, when there is an opportunity to do Asian history, will frequently not take that. I think it sort of worries them. There's one New South Wales survey that suggests, given the choice, 5% choose China, 65% Germany. I think there's a nervousness about dealing with this Asian material.
So what do you first, go on.
Yeah, but first of all, we probably need to look at the world into which the first settler Australians came at the end of the 18th century. I mean, that was a world which still had a very strong China and overall a strong Asia vis-à-vis Europe. I think to pause to think about the context of that time would be worthwhile. It would give students a chance to look at the different civilizations around us, to see how different the countries were around us from, say, Britain and France and the emerging Germany. To stop there and examine that, I think, to look at the cultural traditions a bit. I mean, there wouldn't be great detail, I understand that, but some sense of the world in which we began to build a largely British nation state through the 19th century into the early 20th century.
You also suggest, if I'm reading your paper correctly, that there's other areas, like, for instance, the way in which religion and ideas circulate around the Asian region in very much a state of flux, more than we might realise, that this could be usefully presented to students here, not as something exotic and sort of frightening, but almost to help them prepare for the pluralist society we live in here.
Yeah, to prepare for the pluralist society we're increasingly living in, that's true. But also just in thinking about the issues that Australia is faced with at the moment, I mean, one huge one, of course, is the whole relationship with China at the moment. Mm. But if we are to see China and Asia generally as far more important for Australia than it's been in the past, this can't just be seen in trade terms and in security terms. But how will this, what sort of challenge are we going to get in a possibly, put it this way, post-American Asia? What sort of challenge are we going to get from value systems, different value systems, different cultural perspectives, and the consideration, continuing consideration of different religions? I mean, students could link that current concern, it's very easy to point to that concern, there's so much in the papers at the moment. These current concerns can be linked back to an examination of the societies around us as we built Australia. And of course, those societies then come under European colonialism in the 19th century. And for some Australians, that was a great relief. You know, we didn't have to deal with Asia in that sense, we dealt with colonial powers. But the question then began to be, how much did those colonial powers change that societies? I mean, at the end of colonialism, and really the Japanese expansion in the Second World War brings that colonialism to an end, at that stage, I mean, do we have societies largely moulded in a European way that are not challenging to Australia, or are older ideas, older Asian ideas, beginning to prevail again? Now, that's a very big question for us today, and it's one that we should perhaps hold everything and ask at the end of the Second World War that question, but we ask it again now.
You say the Pacific War was the decisive turning point when suddenly we did become aware of Asian countries like Japan, but you say there were three postponements of our capacity to engage with this material, most recently in the 70s and 80s when we thought, well, they're all becoming, quotes, like us. They're all starting to learn English. And again, we postponed it. Finally, it's changing.
Yeah, I mean, I would have thought, you know, the proverbial man from Mars would look at these European settlers coming to Australia at the beginning of the end of the 18th century and see this extraordinary challenge they would face with societies around them so different from themselves. But first of all, the expansion of European control and influence across the region postponed the need for that reckoning with the Asian region. And then at the end of that, with the Japanese expansion and the Second World War, as I see it anyhow, we then have the very quickly the dividing up of the region around the Cold War. So we're not so much dealing with Asia in the 50s and 60s and 70s as we're dealing with communist versus anti-communist and the others, non-aligned, whatever. No sooner does that finish than we become preoccupied with this unipolar world, this American-led world, where we think that globalization is simply going to make all societies very similar and actually rather like ourselves. So again, we can relax. But it seems to me that in the last 10 years, we're seeing the decline of that globalization dream, if you like, and the decline of American influence, so that we're looking at an Asia that's emerging now, which has, as I put it before, specifically Asian dynamics, where we're going to actually have that reckoning with our regional environments that we've put off in those different ways. Mm. Nothing wrong with that, and it's not as though some people talk as if our ancestors in 1900 were stupid because they had Europe on the mind and not Asia, but in power terms, of course, they were right to do that. But now the situation's different.
And Professor Milner, one of your final suggestions is that, in fact, this could be a win-win for all concerned, that it's not a swap between Europeanness and Asianness, that actually, I think you use a term by a distinguished Indian historian, if we provincialise our Europeanness, we can actually sit in our region particularly well. What are you getting at there?
Well, I think see no problem with having a real emphasis on our European context of Australia. After all, that's the sort of society we're building. But in having that focus, we should be contextualising that. We should be a little more self-conscious in the way we're presenting that European project. And in doing it, it has that second advantage that it reminds us that we actually come to this region and to relations with this region with a heritage of ideas, largely British, Scottish ideas, I suppose, and people from many backgrounds in Australia quickly share.
You're not
those
mentioning
ideas.
The Irish, I've noticed.
Well, I'm sure that's a very important element. But I just Go suspect on. The dominant liberal values
yes.
in the end, which I guess influences whole lots of areas, including, of course, in human rights discussions and so forth, are probably largely British. And in their own way, Asian migrants in Australia have picked up on these attitudes and share them with us now. So this is in by no means an ethnic point of view. It's a body of ideas. But it's important to recognise those ideas, that they're there operating.
Vera, dare I ask you quickly, is this argument being won or not where it counts?
As I said, there's a momentum here. There's a momentum over a long period, and I think we've got a fair way to go before we get a curriculum that fits with the sort of things the Prime Minister said, the business declaration on Asia literacy this year. We've got these great statements on the one hand, but on the other, we've got real history teachers and others with their own particular background, strong in some ways, limited in others, working on a curriculum. And I think the curriculum's got a heck of a distance to go. If all Australians are going to do it, the curriculum will actually prepare us to deal with what looks to be a very Asian future for us, one that no longer is Australia sort of nestling under American influence and power, but one where we're beginning to carve our own role in this region.
Tony Milner, thank you very much indeed for your time.
Thank you.
And Tony Milner is Basham Professor of Asian History at the Australian National University, and we'll try to post his very good address that I heard called The Australian Story and Implications for the National Curriculum. It was presented at the leading 21st Century Schools Forum in Canberra in August, so you might like to go to their website, but we'll hope to have it on soon, as well as Professor Michael Wesley's address about similar things. Do join us after the news. It's 8 o'clock.